Wow, you guys are excited or what? Like, this is going to be an interesting episode. Our guest, John Folis. Wow. Kind of understated, but with a typical New York power behind what he said. And he talks about how he got fired on his way to success.
Yes.
It's a really interesting conversation.
Yes. And it's about advertising and the word. And he was definitely, I'd say, a rebel in the advertising realm.
Yeah.
And this is a bit of a change from the last two episodes we had with Adam. Should we just dive into it?
Let's dive into it. This is going to be great.
All right. By the way, Mark is 61 now. He used to be 60. He's 61 now.
Oh, yeah. And don't forget, subscribe. Please pay attention to our sponsors, the Compton Cowboys, and then also Adrenochrome Cola. Well, actually, the Compton Cowboys aren't our sponsors, but they are a group of people that we support. And if you're listening to this podcast, definitely take the time while you're listening to go to the Compton Cowboys website and see what they're up about.
Yeah. So let's dive into episode 145.
I'm 61.
Sis, hello?
11, 11, 11, 11.
Two outlaws on the lam, taking the back roads through America.
You can't drink enough coffee for this show.
And now it's time for Monday Madness with the Moped Outlaws, Greg and Mark.
And we're live with another episode of Moped Outlaws. And we're here with a very special guest, an advertising genius, a spiritual mentor in the marketing realm, John Folis. Is it Folis or Folis?
You got it right.
Folis. Yep. All right.
Thank you, Greg. I don't know about that spiritual stuff, but I'll go with it.
Well, your documentary said that, you know, why priests are leaving the church. So.
Oh, right. Okay. There you go. I was wondering what the connection was. Okay, so you did see that. Okay.
Yeah. It's a very broad breath of...
So let's go all the way to the deep end of the pool, John. Do you have a spiritual practice? What's your take on spirituality?
No. So, Mark, I don't know if you know what Greg is talking about.
Because I didn't see that email.
You didn't see the email. Because which one of you guys is involved with video production?
Both of us on different levels.
Okay. So
mostly
when I found that out a couple of days ago, I thought I would share a little bit about my experiences with video, not so much production. I'm a creative guy. I'm not a video production guy, but I've been dabbling with video creation for about 20 years. And in 2017, I decided to kind of challenge myself by trying to make a real documentary, at least a documentary that people could consider real. And since I'm not a production guy, I basically made it from my desktop. I ripped off a lot of clips from YouTube and I kind of patched together. I'm a good storyteller. I'm a good writer. And I was listening, if you know who Ken Burns is, who's, half of his stuff, three quarters of it is still images with the Ken Burns effect, right?
Yeah.
So as a fan of his and Michael Moore, I thought, well, maybe I could do something that could pass as a documentary. So the documentary I made talked about something I was very intrigued with, which was people leaving religion. So to answer your question, Mark, no, I don't have a spiritual practice. I'm an observer of behavior. I come from advertising. I'm a student of behavior of people. And, forever I knew people were leaving religion. But when I started tapping into some stories about priests and ministers who are, quote, coming out as non-believers, I thought that was an interesting angle that hadn't really been discussed a lot. So it was with that piece of research that I started making this documentary film, not really knowing exactly how I was going to finish it. But I cobbled together something that lasted 47 minutes, submitted it to some film festivals, And it not only got accepted at the Hollywood International Documentary Film Festival, but it won a Best First Time Filmmaker Award, which is
right other side
up there.
Oh, okay. On top of the filing cabinet.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right.
So, you know, I don't know how legitimate this film festival is, but it sounds legitimate. And then unbeknownst to me, you know, I just had it on Vimeo and YouTube and it was getting a few hundred views. And then it kind of exploded views over a weekend. And I couldn't understand why. And if you know Vimeo, you know it has analytics.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the analytics and they were all these views were coming from a website called topdocumentaryfilms.com. Never heard of it. And I went to the website and there on their main page was my a nice presentation of my film with a great critical review, very positive critical review. And it now has 40,000 views from 98 countries, mainly as a result of that.
Wow. So what was it about the story of a priest leaving religion that captured your personal interest?
I just thought it was an interesting story because it's kind of like the last frontier of coming out, right? You know, it's 20 years ago, it was hard to come out as gay. And now, you know, the thing is coming out as transgender or binary, whatever you call it. And I don't think either one of those is any harder than coming out if you've been a priest or a minister for 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years. And all of a sudden you say, hey, folks, you know, all that stuff I've been saying on a weekly basis to you guys, I kind of think it's all bullshit. Sorry.
Did you ever delve into the ramifications for the people left in the congregation where their spiritual leader?
You know, if I did a documentary, Greg, exclusively on that topic, I think it would have been very interesting to try to get a few of those people on camera and interview them, right?
Right.
But that story to me was just how I introduced the concept of my documentary, Leaving God. That's where it started.
Okay.
And then I kind of got into the statistics about what's been happening in the U.S. over the past 20, 30 years, since basically the internet has really supercharged people walking away from religion. And then I kind of the last third or half of the film kind of was about my personal story, because I thought it would be pretty boring if I just basically acted like a reporter and just used all statistics. I wanted to kind of I think documentaries are most interesting when they have a personal element to them. So I talked about that, including I was very involved when I was in New York for 20 years. I was very active in a church in New York. And about 10 years into my involvement with the church, when the minister found out that I had a Madison Avenue ad agency, he wanted to get together with me and ask me if I could do an ad campaign for the church.
Hmm.
Which was an interesting comment to have him in my office. This is a guy that, you know, would be preaching when I went on Sunday, and now he's in my office talking business with me. And I said, well, I don't know. Do you have any money? And he said, well, we have $150K to spend over 3 months. Could you do anything with that?
That's good money.
And I knew he was talking to other people as well. So I figured, okay, well, let me throw my hat in the ring.
Yeah.
And he said, listen, well, you know, we know you're a professional. We have money to pay you as well for this. We don't see this as doing a pro bono thing. And at that time, I was really passionate about the church. I was really active. Thought it was a cool place. So I spent about 5 or 10 minutes of the documentary talking about the ad campaign I did that ran on subways in New York City. And initially, it was just for that 3 month period, the first year, and it was so successful, I ended up working with them for 14 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
They were a client of yours for 14 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was very successful. It got written up in New York Times and got some international press, and it was edgy, you know, it was edgy. And also it was, if you know anything about my professional background in advertising, wherever I can, I try to introduce humor into my work, because that's a great way to connect with people. And I assume you guys can appreciate that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
you know, like one of my ads for the church, I said, you know, I'm promoting the church, but in essence, I'm selling God. So one of the headlines was make a friend in a very high place.
Got it.
You know, and, yeah. You know, if you can put a smile on someone's face when you're trying to get them to come to the church, I think that helps a lot.
All right. So here you are very engaged with this church on a personal, it's very personal for you.
Right.
You then become involved in the business of the church.
Right.
And is that what dissolved your relationship with the church and religion and ultimately God?
So if you Google Leaving God documentary film, you can find the answer to that question.
Yeah, but if I do that right now during our podcast, people
No. This is for the people, in addition to you guys, but anyone who might be listening.
You don't want to give away the ending.
Listen, you know,
That's fair, John.
Yeah, I mean, when you watch
I love that answer. That's good because it broadens people's experience of you into really getting into your art. The question I had when you mentioned humor in your advertising, and particularly the campaign for this church, is humor an element of this thing that you coined called G-cred?
Ah, you've done your research.
A little bit.
No.
Don't give them full credit, Johnny.
So, Greg, do you know what Mark is talking about?
No idea.
Okay. So now we flipped the script here. Okay.
That's why we're such good hosts we work together. We're a tag team. We just don't need masks.
Before I start talking about it, so what do you know about G-cred, Mark?
Well, for me, my understanding of it is extremely limited based on just a little bit of reading I did on the link you sent me. But from a conceptual standpoint, I can just sort of extract what I think about it, which is, you know, gangster cred. He's an OG is part of the vernacular. But what it could also mean is grounded credibility. It's this idea that in the moment, again, I'm extrapolating, you gain something with the audience. They suddenly feel your authority. But okay.
Let me explain. So when did Google start? 2008, maybe?
I think it was a little before, but
okay, around that time. So whenever it was that Google came out, everyone was talking about Google and how to be found on Google. It was a new thing, and it was a new conversation that people were having. And at the time, I was active in my business and marketing. So the question for my clients was, how do we play with Google? And I decided to I got very involved in understanding the way that you need to approach online search if you're a business. And the term G-cred does not stand for gangster cred. It stands for Google cred. Google cred. So I came up with that term shortly after Google came out and people were talking about how to be found. And the point of G-cred was, if you can't be found on Google, you have no credibility. So G-cred, you know, which is not a new concept in 2024, but in... To 2010, when I came up with it, people were saying, okay, I gotta understand this better. And it wasn't just for businesses. It was for anyone who wants to have credibility. If you are just a professional person and you're working on your personal brand, when recruiters are considering hiring you for a job, they're going to go to Google to check you out on LinkedIn and wherever else you might be. And my point was that you got to start thinking like you're a product, even though you're an individual, and do whatever you can to create your own brand. And G-cred is, how do you do that? And, you know, I get into it more specific. You need to post, you need to write. If you're a writer, you need to, you know, post on blogs. You develop your own persona. So people, when they search your name, and they will search your name at some point, like what they see. And you as a person like what is going out there, because if you don't create your own identity, then you're at the mercy of whatever else, you know, your arrest record or whatever else shows up when you get someone Googles you.
Yeah. I have a question for you. How in your expertise of marketer, promoter, advertiser, how did you find a way for these giant e-commerce brands to connect on a personal level with their potential clients? What I'm thinking of is like Starbucks. There's this knee-jerk reaction of they're evil. Or like when Google came out, you were mentioning their mission statement was don't be evil, which they've since dropped. They're evil. No. So it seems like there is a very prolific energy for a common person to react negatively to a giant brand. How is that real? Do you find that to be real? Is that a challenge?
So when I was talking about this, came up with G-Cred, I was not interfacing with any giant brands at the time. I was working with smaller local and regional clients and a lot of entrepreneurs, small business owners and things like that.
So when you say you're a Madison Avenue advertiser, did you ever get to?
Well, that was later. Yeah.
Yeah. I started working for the big agencies on accounts like Pizza Hut and Coke and Volkswagen.
I was a
peon at the time. You know, I was a 20-something-year-old kid that kept getting fired from every other job.
Right.
What was the reason you kept getting fired? Was that like a value system where you were just like, no bullshit? Like, I'm not going to deal with your bullshit. Is that kind of it?
First of all, if you know anything about the advertising business and certainly anything about Madison Avenue advertising, it's not that hard to get fired. First of all, you know, it's a very intense, very highly competitive, very cutthroat business, especially in New York on Madison Avenue. Having said that, it also doesn't help if the guy who brings you into the agency is not there anymore. And in two of the four times I got canned, that was the case about a month or so after I was brought in. The guy bolted for a better job and I was kind of left hanging. And it doesn't necessarily mean your days are numbered, but in most cases, it does. I mean, you have to be a really, really good politician and ass kicker to figure out how to navigate the waters when your rabbi is no longer there, you know, protecting you, covering your ass. You better do some fancy footwork if you want to last. And I knew I was pretty naive about office politics, as I assume most 20-somethings are.
Do you think that you evolved into a wolf of Wall Street in your professional career?
Well, that's a different profession we're talking about when we say
No. What I mean is, you said yourself that in this advertising world, especially on Madison Avenue, it's cutthroat. You got to be political. It moves fast.
Yeah.
Did you evolve to embody that?
No. That wasn't my thing. You know, I'd say a good number. In fact, might even argue most of the people who are successful in any big business are not necessarily the smartest and most talented.
Politics shows us that.
And I realized that very quickly in the ad business, that the guys who had the management jobs, the senior jobs, were not that talented creatively, but they really knew how to navigate the corporate waters. And so I think ideally it's great if you can be both, be super talented and great at navigating. But if you're working in a corporate environment and you want to succeed and you have to pick one of those two things, the ability to understand and navigate corporate politics is the better choice.
Okay.
So the key, to answer your question, no, I never made that choice. I wasn't interested in that. And I just realized that, you know, I was taught and always focused my energy on being the best creative, most talented, smartest creative person I could ever be. And that's what I wanted to be. And if I couldn't apply those skills in a big agency, I just figured I had to find another way to exercise those talents, which ended up starting with freelancing.
So you created your own agency.
Yeah, not that simple, but yeah, it started with saying, you know, fuck these big agencies and let me find some smaller agencies that aren't so steeped in politics, that are more interested in someone like me that can just solve their problems creatively and see if I could start making a living just by being a hired gun, and did that for about 2 years and had some success that attracted a guy who was a super business development guy, who after 20 minutes of having a beer with me said, I think we should start an agency.
That's what I'm wondering.
I said, so, what's your name again?
So that's what I'm wondering. So you then partnered with someone who was able to traverse those cutthroat waters on a business level, which allowed you to do the creative.
You know, we're talking two different things here. I'm talking about cutthroat corporate environment. And this guy was a sales guy who could, you know, kick open doors and get meetings. So different conversation, different thing. But he was super aggressive. He was a New York guy, which I am not. So he was very street smart, super, super aggressive, wouldn't stop at anything to get a meeting. And, you know, that wasn't my thing. He was looking for a brilliant creative guy. And I wasn't necessarily looking for a guy like him, but he kind of fell in my lap. He called me out of the blue because he had seen some of the creative work that I had done that was getting attention actually in New York, and said, I got to, as I was saying before, he decided he wanted to find me and meet me because he had been looking for, he had similar frustrations at big agencies. Even though he was on the business side, he didn't like the corporate environment either and was very entrepreneurial. And he always believed that if he could find a really talented creative guy, that he could succeed by getting meetings with smaller clients that just needed someone like us to solve their advertising and marketing problems. And so that's how our agency started.
So typically how long from the point of view, like he kicks in the door, you've got to have a concept distilled down to something really viable for the client that's going to. And so what's your creative process like? How do you take all these rambling concepts of executives around their products and marketing and distill it down to this really compelling, essential core terms?
Well, there's a saying that advertising is part art and part science. It's a combination of those two things. And sometimes you need more the science part, analytical part. Sometimes you need more the creative part. So it starts with the strategic, analytic, scientific, if you will, part. You meet with the client, and you know that's one of the things I think as a creative person, that allowed me to have the success that I do, because some creatives you'll find if you work in the business are just these really flaky creative guys that just, you know, they say it should be pink because they like pink, and they don't. There's no logic behind it. You know, they got a lot of creativity, but not a lot of logic and analytic perspective on things. I've always been very strategic. So that's where it starts, Mark. You meet with the client and you try to understand what his business challenge is.
Or what her is, challenge.
What's that?
Or her challenge.
His or her. There we go.
We're from San Francisco.
Okay. There you go. So you have to have multiple conversations, really understand the client's product or service. You have to know it inside out, because if you really don't understand what it is you're selling, you can't be successful at it. And then you have to understand what, and sometimes you can challenge a client, say, listen, I hear what you're saying, that this is what you want to do, but I'm not sure that's the best strategy. And that may be part of the problem, because the best creative for the wrong strategy is not going to work.
Got it.
So sometimes a client is smart enough to have the right strategy, but sometimes they're not. And you have to have a discussion, because We want the client to be successful, and we want them to be believe that we can solve their problem, but we have to agree that the strategy makes sense. So it starts with that. And then you have to know part. The other part of it is, who is your audience? You have to really know who you're talking to, because in order to craft a creative message, it's got to touch an emotional nerve in the person that you're speaking to. So these are all the conversations and things that have to be decided and agreed on before you even begin to start, figuring out what your creative is going to be. And once you know that stuff, it actually makes it easier to come up with the creative, because you have certain parameters that you have to stay within. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So what is it that most content creators now fail to recognize about how they exploit their social media?
I can't speak for that, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's a lack of doing some of the things I just mentioned. You know, being clear on a strategy, having a right strategy, knowing who your audience is, you know, stuff like that. The other problem I would say, Mark, is that, and I found this a lot when I left the big agency world and started working with a lot of solopreneurs who were, you know, very good at whatever business they were running, not so good at marketing it. You know, they're not trained in marketing. You know, the thing about marketing and advertising is everyone thinks they can do it because everyone knows what a commercial is, right? Oh, I know what it is. I know what I can post something on Instagram. They all know how to post something on Instagram. But if you don't, if you have no training in advertising or marketing and you're not that talented creatively, post and create all you want, but chances are it's not going to be that effective. So one of the things that I find with a lot of people who try to do their own content creation or marketing, if they have any kind of a business, is that they try to do it themselves and they don't really incorporate the help of an outside person that can look at their business. First of all, understands marketing, understands digital marketing, content creation, but also has an objectivity about their business. This is another problem. You know, when you have a baby, I don't care how ugly that baby is, you think it's beautiful, right?
What are you saying?
that's the point that I'm trying to make with some of these business owners. They don't have the perspective that they really, really need to be able to present their product or service to the public, because they don't see the faults in it. They don't see
What I see very challenging in today's social marketing is the social marketers that are hired are concentrating on getting likes and getting people attached to the Facebook page or Instagram account instead of the sales. Like, I've been involved with a couple of marketing campaigns where marketeers were hired and they'd come back with all these stats. We got 50,000 people. And you're like, yeah, we sold no books, nothing sold.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Greg. I can really feel for anyone who is smart enough to know that they would probably benefit from bringing an outside marketing quote expert, but trying to find one who's legit. I mean, I can write a whole book on that. I posted, I actually, 15 years ago, when I was active, wrote several blog posts on how to qualify a marketing resource to help you, how to qualify them. Because there's so many shysters out there, so many bullshitters out there, that they all have their programs. Yeah. You know, do my program.
Yeah.
You've seen them all on YouTube. They're fast talkers, they're hustlers. You know, they sound great, and, you know, many of them, not all of them, but many of them are pretty convincing. And it makes it very challenging for someone who wants someone who is not like that, who doesn't have a program, who's really willing to, you know, every one size marketing doesn't fit all. It's not cookie cutter. And, you know, again, these are some of the mantras that I would toss out when I was marketing myself. If you go on LinkedIn, you'll probably see a bunch of posts from years ago where I kind of would post all this stuff. Good marketing is very customized to the product or service that you're working with. So anyone who's promoting a system, I would run away as fast as you can from that person.
Now, do you see an intersection between the way that people are capturing attention and creating this idea of attraction in their audience with religion and these kind of shyster marketers? Isn't there kind of an intersection in the way that approach occurs, where it's seduction of people's highest aspirations gets caught up in the intention and agenda of another institution?
Can you give me an example of what you're talking about?
Well, it seems to me like someone who pulls you in to spend money on their marketing campaign that's not really qualified is trying to get you to believe in some kind of thing that's not real. And I think the same is true with religions. There's this idea that, you know, we get people to be devoted and have kind of a blindness that's triggered by their emotional responses and not necessarily rational reason.
But here I would...
Religion and marketing have a lot in common.
There's a caveat to that, too, is I think quite often the preacher or the marketer with their system, they don't know that they're bullshitting you. They really believe in.
Some of them do.
Some of them do know.
Some of them do.
Yeah, well, that's probably true. We won't name any names.
But there's an inherent sort of thing that gets exploited in the listener, right? There's this aspect of pulling the emotional heartstrings of what at the root level, what is engagement or capturing audience, right? And is that something that you've got the science and background of? Do you have understand the psychology of that? And how's that work?
Yeah, it is. A lot of advertisers make the mistake of just thinking that if they can just, present all the facts, the information about their product, it'll get people to buy it. And in many cases it will, but you know, if you already know you want a camera, or then all you need to know is the specs and the price.
That's
all you need to know. But if you're selling something else and a lot of other things, you need to make an emotional connection with your audience.
So I saw on your website, one of the cases was the umbrella company that had zero market knowledge. And from what I saw on that case, you said the piece to generate interest was concentrating on the quality of the umbrella compared to the rest of the market, which to me logically has no emotional connection.
Right.
So did emotion come into that campaign?
Yeah. So I think you have to be a New Yorker, maybe in San Francisco as well. But whenever it rains in New York for like a long period of time, you start to see a bunch of umbrellas in the trash can. These are those $3 umbrellas that people buy because they get out of work and they realize they're getting rained on, and they see a guy selling umbrellas that works for about 10 minutes and then it breaks and they throw it in the trash. So, you know, after a couple of rainy days in New York, you see these trash cans with all these broken umbrellas. So one of the outdoor posters we did, now you're testing my memory, Greg, because you're asking me to remember something that was done about 35 years ago.
That's all right. We're all old here. You can make it up, and we'll agree with you.
Well, it's not just age. It's just that I've done a lot of campaigns over the years, and that was just one of them. But I do remember the visual. So the media was these outdoor phone kiosks. This is when they had telephones in New York. So these giant phone posters. And one of the visual that I used was a New York City trash can with all these trashed umbrellas in it. And I forget the headline, but any New Yorker who's walking the streets of New York has an emotional reaction when they see that trash can with all these broken umbrellas in
it.
You know? Yeah. And I don't know, the headline was something like, if you want an umbrella that lasts more than 10 minutes or something like that.
Right.
You know, so in that sense, that image, I think, makes an emotional connection if you're a New Yorker, because you can relate to that.
Right. So that's brilliant, because you're taking the fact that this is a higher quality umbrella and you're finding an emotional way to communicate that.
Right. Right.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
Right.
Did this play a role in why Harvard Business School picked up your Sorrel Ridge campaign?
So that's another campaign.
What was that like for you?
So that's another campaign, Mark and Greg. I'm not assuming you know about that either, right? Okay. So this Sorrel Ridge, we're going back in time here, and the year was 1988. I was 34, I think. And been working with this new business guy for about 6 months. And nothing is really happening with this guy. We're really not getting any great opportunity. We're getting like a brochure here or something like that. And he comes up to me and says, John, I got a meeting with this company in New Jersey. They're called Sorrel Ridge, and they sell this jam. And they want a TV commercial. Now, a TV commercial, you know, was something to get excited about. We were two guys working out of our apartments. And I said, it's a jam. I never heard of it. And he said, well, we're going to meet the guy tomorrow. He's going to tell us all about it. He said, it's all fruit jam. Now, in 1988, that was news.
Mm-hmm.
No one thought of the ingredients in jam back in 1988. You just go to the store, you buy your Smucker's preserves, and that was it. So we met with the guy, and I said, you know, I'm sorry, but I've never heard of your product. He said, well, that's because do you ever shop in health food stores? And I said, no. And he said, well, that's where we sell this stuff, because it's healthy. And he said, what we'd like to do now is break out of the health food market and go mainstream and be on the shelves next to Smucker's. But no one knows who we are, and the reality is that Smucker sucks, because if you care at all about what you're putting into your body, which not everyone does, but some people do, you should know that Smucker's is 75% corn syrup, 15% refined sugar, and 8% fruit.
You're dumping a bag of sugar into your body.
And we're 100% fruit and fruit juice, and that's it. So that's the message we want to get out to people. And, you know, we don't have a lot of money, but we think if we spend some money in the California market and New York market to start, you know, that's maybe we'll get, that's where some people might actually respond to this. And he said, by the way, I hate Smucker's, so if you want to do something competitive, that's fine with me.
Ooh, nice. Okay.
Now, that's all I needed to hear.
Right.
To get excited.
Knives
out. It's rare that we would have an opportunity with a client who, A, would want a TV commercial, B, would have a great product, and C, is willing, you know, to like kick some butt with his advertising.
Yeah.
You know, so that was like, you know, three for three on what you look for with a prospect. So I was so excited. And I don't know, Mark, did you see the creative that we ended up doing?
No, but what sparked my interest was that Harvard Business School decided it was an important case study in advertising at that time. And I was wondering what it was about that experience for you. How did that feel to have Harvard Business School?
So that's the backdrop for me to talk about Harvard. I think you need to know what we're talking about here. So that was the client that we were working with, Sorrel Ridge, which I think he's since sold his company, so I'm not even sure it even exists anymore. So if you're looking for Sorrel Ridge, I don't know if you could find it, although maybe in health food stores. So we did a campaign that basically took Smucker's tagline and dismantled it.
Mm.
The tagline. Do you know Smucker's tagline?
Isn't it like with a name like Smucker's, it's got to be good.
There you go. And we said, that's bullshit, basically. So the entire commercial basically was focused on the Smucker's tagline. The top part said with a name like Smucker's, and the bottom third of the praise was it has to be good. And every time, and we started to name the ingredients that's actually in Smucker's. And every time we named it a different ingredient, a pair of hands, let me see if I could do this. A pair of hands would come up and paste over the last line where it says it has to be good with it might be good. It could be good.
Nice.
Is it really so good?
Perfect.
And then we flip. You're laughing, so you get it.
Yeah.
And then we flip to a beauty shot of Sorrel Ridge surrounded by, you know, beautiful fruit and say, you know, fortunately is something better. Sorrel Ridge with 100% fruit juice and fruit juice. So that's why we say with Sorrel Ridge with 100% fruit, it has to be better.
Yeah.
So our tagline actually played off of Smucker's tagline.
Right.
Nice. Now, we thought we were going to get our ass sued.
Yeah.
You know, and right. We present the client loved it. Well, first of all, it was kind of funny because I'm presenting this commercial. And as a stand up comedian, if one of you guys have done, you know what it is like to be standing up in front of people. OK, so I'm up there and I have this idea presented on cards that are, you know, 8.5 by 11.
Right. Right.
As the commercial is progressing, I'm flipping like flip cards. And 10 seconds into the presentation, the president of the company who sees the Smucker's, he's going to be spending $350,000 on this commercial.
You got the wrong client, sir.
And I say, okay, this is how you should spend the money. And I show them the first frame, which is this fucking right. Smucker's tagline.
Right, right.
And he interrupts me and he's like ready to throw us out of the building saying, I waited. Because we actually delayed the presentation because we were fine tuning and it was getting really frustrated. And we said, no, you're going to love this. Give us another week. And we go in. The first thing we show is his competitor's tagline, who he absolutely hates.
Right.
And he basically stands up and goes, what the fuck are you guys doing? Are you guys fucking kidding me? Can I say that?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
He did.
Yes, you can.
Are you guys fucking serious? You want to use the fucking, I'm going to spend $350,000 on the fucking Smucker's. I said, forget his name. I said, listen, just let me present the fucking commercial. Give me another fucking 60 seconds and maybe you'll see what I'm trying to do here. Okay. And I could see as I'm presenting this commercial, all of a sudden, his whole face changes from wanting to like literally kill me to want to go come up and like give me a bear hug.
Yeah.
And at the end of the commercial, he's sitting there and he goes, you know what? I think I love you guys.
Wow. Awesome.
He says, I think I love you.
Yeah.
He said, but I got to run this by our attorneys.
Yep.
And 2 days later, he calls me. And he says, hey, guys, he said, I love the commercial, but the attorneys are telling me that, you know, this could be a problem. And I said, well, what's the problem? He said, well, we're basically dismantling, they're trashing our main competitors. You know, Smucker's is a big company. They got a lot of lawyers here. They got a lot of money. And they're not going to be happy if I run this commercial that basically trashes their tagline. That's like their whole equity is their tagline. That's how people know them. They've been using it, you know, since 1947. You think they're going to be okay with this? I said, so that's what the lawyers told you, right? And I said, okay. Did they say that we're saying anything that isn't true? Because that's their job. To say that anything, you know, anything that can be legally truly actionable.
Right. Right. Truly.
Did they
right.
say anything like that? And he said, well, no. They just said that Smucker's is probably going to sue. And I said, great. That's good news. You know why? Let's hope they sue. Run the fucking commercial. Let's hope they sue. And then we'll tell every fucking news outlet about this story. and it'll make front page news on Ad Week and Marketing Week, and maybe even some, you know, normal news stations. And he pauses and he said, let me talk to the lawyers again.
a lot of risk involved.
And he comes back and he said, well, 2 days later, he said, the lawyers still say we shouldn't do this because we're going to get sued. But you know what? Fuck the lawyers. We're going to run it. I want to run it.
Nice.
That guy had moxie, and so do you, John.
So you can't, you know, and listen, not a lot of clients would have done that, right? So, you know, I can take some credit for coming up with the concept, but, you know, he was going to be the one that had to spend the money on the legal fees.
Right.
If smokers did sue. So I ran the commercial and we're waiting now.
Where did you run it?
We ran it, in California and New York.
Okay.
Different markets.
Right.
I wasn't doing my partner was a media guy, so he bought the media and we got a commission on the, if you're an ad agency, you make money, on commission. So if you're spending $350K, back then you were getting 15% commission on that. Wow, which was nice. A nice chunk of change for us.
Yeah.
So we're waiting, and day one goes by, no cease and desist. And, you know, the other thing I said to the client, I said, listen, the worst thing that is going to happen is that you're going to send you a letter. And the letter is going to be a standard
cease and desist.
That's the they're not going to sue you right off the bat.
Right.
They're going to give you an opportunity to cease and desist, and then you have an option to do that. Do you know we got no letter?
Really? Not even a letter? That's surprising. Not yet.
So, you know, credit to the Smucker's attorneys who were smarter than I thought. Because one of the things I said, the client's name was Mark, I think. I said, if the Smucker's attorneys know anything, they're going to be smart enough to know that the worst thing they could do is to make a fuss about this. Because, first of all, you're not saying anything that isn't true. And if they start making a fuss about this and it comes out in public, there's going to be a conversation about the ingredients that are in Smucker's jam. Right. And I don't think Smucker's wants that conversation to go public. So, you know, they might send you a cease and desist, but, you know, you don't have to cease and desist if you want. Let them sue you. So we got no letter, and the campaign ran. And about a month later, the client calls you up. And he said, guys, he said, I can't believe this. We've been tracking this for a month, and sales are up 90%.
Wow.
90%.
Damn.
Now, for the category of jams and jellies during that same period, up 2.7%.
That's
crazy. He said, I want to do another media buy. I'm going to borrow, beg, and steal for another $500,000. He said, I don't have it, but I'm going to find it, because there's such a direct result between what I'm spending and the return, which that rarely happens,
right,
you know,
right.
When you do that. But because he ran the commercial, and the commercial just, you know, raised a lot of eyebrows, got a lot of attention. And that's, to answer your question, Mark, that's how I became a Harvard Business case study.
Wow.
And how did it feel for you to be in the halls of Harvard being queried about what drew you to create that kind of campaign? Did they query
you?
Well,
I didn't get the call. The client did.
Got it.
So all I knew was, hey, guys, by the way, you know, Harvard Business Review is doing a case study on this. And we said, great.
Did that give you and your partner?
But we were interviewed on CNBC, which was kind of cool.
Right. So, like, did your personal business thrive once word of this campaign got out into the world?
Well, you know, that campaign put us on the map, because we weren't really an agency. Like I said, that was 6 months after I was collaborating with this guy who I barely knew. We probably, you know, at that point, I had only interacted with him 7 or 8 times. And suddenly, because we're now getting a commission on this media and have, you know, some money to spend, he was saying, we need to formalize this partnership and become an agency, because we were getting written up in the trade presses as well, in Ad Week and Ad Age. And we wanted to be known as an ad agency, a real ad agency, so we could, you know, leverage that to get more business. So, it was like hitting a grand slam your first time. You're a rookie. player and you get up to bat your first time, you knock it out of the park with the bases loaded.
So you hit a grand slam and you become a legitimate ad agency, and the ad world is watching you guys now because fuck, these guys just won the game. Who knew? All right. Were you able to continue a high level of success?
We were.
Well, yeah, because he went on to win.
Hey, Mark, I was asking John.
Okay.
Yeah, oops.
Right, right.
See you all.
So my, like most things in life, and certainly in business and even, you know, the entertainment world, Paul McCartney and John Lennon were both talented individuals, but it was their collaboration that made the Beatles successful, right?
And so, Ringo and George.
Yeah. So my partner was really good at what he did, which was a very key part to get a meeting and get clients and know how to manage clients. And I was really good at the creative part and the strategic thinking. So because we both were exceptional, I think, at our individual responsibilities, we continued to get opportunities to pitch business. We were beating out major agencies with our creative work because all things are on a level playing field. Sometimes when you're pitching work, the client will just pick, if it is a pitch, it's a shootout. They call it a shootout, and the client will just choose, the team that he thinks can solve his problem best creatively. And if you're a worldwide mega agency, you have no bigger advantage than if you're just two guys working out of your apartments when you're basically showing work. And that's how we were able to, you know, beat out in many cases, much more, big and established agencies. And we, within 2 or 3 years, actually after 3 years of working together, we were the second most award-winning agency in New York City.
So, with full permission to give yourself a full pat on the back or whatever is appropriate, do you feel that you personally had a creative genius that gave an edge to these shootouts?
That, you know, my strength was my creative work, my thinking, but, like I said, it's always a collaboration. And, even though, you know, I started out as an art director, you know, which meant I knew how to design an ad. And when I started learning the computer, I learned how to use the programs, you know, but I'm old enough to say that, you know, I was using magic markers back in the day when I had to, you know, do an ad and draw.
Paste up and then Quark and then Photoshop.
Oh, there you go. There you go. There you go. That's right. So, you know, my artistic design system meant that I could, you know, once we had the idea, I could craft and put it together. But I've always been a good writer, and less so when I was at a big agency, because you have to work with the writer. They match you up with a writer, and that doesn't mean that the writer is the only one who writes. Sometimes the writer will come up with a visual, and sometimes you as the art director will come up with the headline. But when I was doing my own thing, especially when I was hired as freelance, they'd say, well, you're an art director, right? And I said, well, actually, I'm an art director and a writer. And when they thought they were getting two for one, they were more apt to say, well, let's hire this guy for a day and see if he's as good as he says. And that's how I became so, I think, successful freelancing, because they realized I was kind of ambidextrous that way. So anyway, going back to your question, Mark, a lot of the ads and campaigns that we did were successful, things I came up on my own, but not in every case. And in the case of Soar Ridge, I did pull in a guy that I had worked with before that helped me come up with that. So that wasn't totally my thing.
Got it.
Okay.
So I want to ask two more questions myself beyond our normal questions. How are we doing on time, John? Can you go a little over an hour?
I'm meeting a buddy of mine to jam. I'm trying to get a rock band going. So I
all right, I'll be brief. So how did this all culminate in you becoming a speaker and a teacher and a professor?
Okay, so when you have a job at one of the top agencies in New York, I should say I did get fired from a number of agencies, but they were really the best agencies.
So, put that on your resume.
So I've been fired from the best.
While I still was employed at these agencies. I don't know if you know anything about the. So in New York City, there's three top ad schools, three of the top ad schools in the country. I know Art Center. There's one in L.A. Art Center. You may know. I think there's probably one in San Francisco as well. I'm not sure. There's certainly some top agencies in San Francisco. Yeah. Is Bieber Silverstein still around?
No. The only thing I really know about is Deloitte.
Okay,
but those aren't. They're New York, aren't they?
Yeah, I thought Deloitte was a law firm.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe okay. I don't understand the agency.
Okay. And anyway, so School of Visual Arts, Parsons School of Design, and Fashion Institute of Technology are the three schools. And I actually ended up teaching at all three of them. But the first one was School of Visual Arts. When you start working at some of these top agencies, you start rubbing shoulders with other creatives who are actually teaching at night at these schools. And I thought it would be kind of cool and fun to make some extra money and share what I know about the ad business and teach some students. So that's what I did. You just basically, once they know that you're working at one of the top agencies and we're, you know, a friend of a couple other guys who are teaching there, they just say, okay, well, what do you want to teach and what night works for you? And then you end up teaching. And, you know, the money's not great, but it was kind of fun being a teacher.
Yeah.
I did that for a while and ended up starting at School of Visual Art. No, I started out at Parsons School of Design. Then I did it at SVA, and then I did it at FIT.
Okay, question number two. You've done so much for nonprofits like UNICEF, MAD, League of Women Voters. What are you most proud of in your career? What is your biggest impact in society from that point of view?
So this is a great story. I'll try to keep it simple. Yes, I've always been interested in public service. When I was just starting out in the business, I came across a quote by one of the ad legends who said that the advertising people in this country are the most skilled communicators in history. Wouldn't it be an amazing thing if we applied our communication skills and creativity toward helping to make the world a better place? And that quote to me was so powerful. I actually framed it and put it up on my wall because I really believed it. I really, really believed it. And as a result, very early on in my career, whenever I had the opportunity, would do work. And sometimes I just see a cause or see something that would spark a creative idea. And that was the case when I was watching a PBS special on Adolf Hitler and found out that he was abused as a kid basis. He was beaten on a regular basis by his father. So the way my mind works was, you know, as I'm, you know, eating chips and watching TV, a light bulb appears above my head. And I said, there's a great ad for child abuse here somewhere. And, you know, if I use Hitler, it might get some people's attention, right?
Yeah.
So I came up with an ad, showed it to my partner, and said, oh, my God, who was Jewish, by the way. He said, wow. This is one of the most amazing ads I've ever seen. We got to find a child abuse organization that would consider running this. And I said, okay, well, that's your job. Go for it. Yeah. And, a week later, he said, John, I'm really struggling. He said, I called a few places and, I said, I'd really like to get a meeting so I can show the ad. We don't want to just, you know, mail it in to them. We want to, set it up when we present it. I said, well, where's the main the national organ? He said, well, they're in Chicago. You know, we can't meet. They're in Chicago. And I said, well, you never know. Give them a call. Just tell them we have something. Maybe they'll come to New York. Who knows? Next day, he says, hey, John, you're not going to believe this. These guys are coming to New York, and I told them we have an ad for them, and they want to meet with us. I said, you're kidding me. I said, that's brilliant. He said, and they want to meet us at the offices of the NBA. I said, well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I said, why the NBA? I said, I don't know. They have a meeting with the NBA, and that's where they want us to meet us. So we go up there. We don't know why they're meeting with the NBA. And we figured, you know, we're going to go in a side room, whatever, and present to these two women. So we go up there with this Hitler ad. And the receptionist finally says, okay, you know, they're ready to see you now. We walk into a conference room, and there's eight people around a table. Two of them are from the child abuse organization. The other six are with the NBA.
It's brilliant.
Yeah. And I have an ad that's featuring Adolf Hitler about child abuse.
Yeah. Wow.
And yeah. I have six and basketball people looking at me, and I'm thinking, what the fuck is this?
What did I just jump into?
Is this an episode of Jackass or something? Am I being, you know, punked here?
Yeah.
So, you know, this is where my public, presentation skills really, you know, so I'm just saying, talk about a tough audience, right?
Yeah.
So I, you know, focus on the two women, and they kind of set it up, and all of a sudden, and they look at this ad, and I look at around the NBA, and, you know, some of them are trying to, like, you know, try not to crack up, you know, they're just like, you know, rolling their eyes, and they don't know what this is. This has nothing to do with them. And so the woman says, well, that's an interesting idea, but it's really not our strategy. We think this could be too offensive for people. And I'm like really frustrated because this is the national organization. My partner thinks this ad is brilliant. I think it's brilliant. And they're basically rejecting it. So I said, listen, yes, it is controversial, but, you know, do you have millions of dollars to spend in advertising? You want people to get attention. You want people to talk about this, right? So people will react to this. So people are going to be upset about this. That'll give you an opportunity, maybe even to go on TV and talk about your organization and why you think it's important to, you know, why this issue is so important, you know, because this just shows that you don't even have to have a kid to be concerned about child abuse, because look at Hitler, someone like that who doesn't get the therapy he needs, and we're going to have a fucked up world by all these people who are abused as kids that we've ignored. Or, you know, this is a great talking point. And they said, well, sorry, we're not interested, but we'd like to talk to you about something else.
Have you heard of
have you guys done any TV? Have you guys done any TV? And we said, yeah. And I'm like not wanting to like let go of this ad. My partner is starting to kick me under the table, like, shut the fuck up. Because they start telling us about this deal that they just did with the NBA, where the NBA is going to give them $5 million worth of TV media time during the NBA playoffs. And they need a TV commercial, or a few of them, like, now.
And you're trying to sell them Hitler, and your partner's like, shut up. There's $5 million on the table.
He was literally kicking me under the table. Again, I'm a little slow to realize some things, you know, about fired in corporate environments. But once I did shut up, my eyes started getting pretty big because first of all, I love basketball in the NBA, and to think that we could be doing child abuse commercials. But then I'm thinking, okay, what's the catch here? They want to use their freaking players, you know, just talking to camera with a little kid on their knee reading from a teleprompter. And I said, I don't want to do that. So they said, are you interested? And I said, well, that depends. And they're looking at me, and my partner's looking at me like, he's starting to kick me again. Like, depends. Yeah. National TV. And I said, well, it depends because, you know, first of all, you know, we'd love to work with you guys. And we understand that as NBA, you want to have some ID with your players. But if you're interested in just having a player just talking to the camera for 30 seconds or 60 seconds, you can get any production company to do that. You wouldn't want to hire, you know, we're a creative agency. And to be honest with you, to do something really effective that's going to cut through with your message, I think you want to do something more than just have a boring guy reading from a teleprompter. You want to do something with a concept. So if you'd be willing to see what we come up with creatively, we'd be happy to do it. Would you be willing to do that? And there was a pause for about 10 seconds as everyone was kind of like, look, the NBA people were looking at each other. Do you really want to do this? Dude, this guy just showed us a fucking ad with Hitler. What the fuck? What was working for us was time. They were on a deadline and they were from Chicago and they didn't really have the time to start interviewing ad agencies. And we had sent them some other ads before we got the meeting with them. We did. My partner had sent them basically a package of some of the other work that I had done, which they had seen. So they did know that I wasn't going to use mass murderers in every ad that I did, you know. We weren't the mass murderer ad agency, right? So they, you know, with some hesitation, they said, yeah, well, you know, let's see what you come up with. Sure, you know. And so to answer your question, I came up with three campaigns, and I did do these on my own. And one was, I'll tell you a couple. They were pretty simple. One was a long shot, black and white film, very moody at night, this lonely black kid by himself on a city basketball court under a streetlight, basking, but
dribbling,
bouncing the ball and shooting by himself. And for 10 seconds, you hear nothing other than the sound of the ball bouncing and him shooting at the basket. And finally, the announcer comes in as the camera just kind of pans. It slowly moves in on him, says the reason Robert isn't leaving is not because he doesn't want to be beaten on the basketball court. It's because he doesn't want to be beaten at home.
Wow.
And then it just cuts to a graphic that says no one wins with child abuse.
Brilliant.
And then the NBA logo sponsored by the NBA and child abuse. And that was our connection. No one wins with child abuse. That was the connecting thread with the NBA. That was one of the spots.
That's beautiful.
And it was giving people goosebumps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other one was one of their players who was Mark Eaton, who played for the Utah Jazz at the time. He's 7'4". And I'll try to demo it. He leans into the camera like this. And we use a slight wide angle lens. Well, first of all, wait, the camera starts at his feet and slowly, slowly tilts up his body again for 15, 16, 18 seconds. And we finally get to his face. And he finally looks into the camera like this. And he goes, if it makes you nervous having someone my size in your face, now you know how your kid feels when you're in his.
That's nice.
And it's talking to the parents about, you know, you have to really appreciate what it's like to be a 3-foot child when you're screaming at him, right?
Yeah.
And so that was how can I connect basketball with child abuse prevention? And when I thought about the size differential between one of us were standing next to a 7'5", now you know how you would feel if you're 5 years old standing next to your dad, right?
Right. The other thing I love with that first example is we have this scenario. I have a scenario in my mind of these great, like Curry, you know, these great players of today and how they just practice all the time. And in that first commercial, you're showing the impetus for practice was because there was no home to go home to.
Right. Right.
Which is heartbreaking.
Yeah. So those are commercials that I wrote myself. I art directed myself. I did the storyboards. I presented. I did everything on it. And not with a lot of time because they said, you know, we've got this media, the playoffs. We can't delay the playoffs. They're happening, you know, in March or whenever. Yeah. And we need to not only approve a concept, but be able to shoot these spots and get our players. And you got to, you know, the players don't come to us. We go to the players. They're playing on their schedule. So, you know, we've got to. So I was on a plane to Chicago to meet what's his name? He was the center of the Chicago Bulls. Bill, can't remember his name now. But we shot with three players, which was really cool to be on a plane, you know, shooting these players and talking to them. And I was introducing myself. I said, just so you know, because I was kind of like directing these players to read to the camera. And I'd say, I'm the creative director. I'm the ad guy. And he said, oh, you're like the Darren Stevens in Bewitched, right? I don't know if you guys are old enough to remember.
Yeah, we're old enough to know.
But I remember he said, oh, you're like Darren in Bewitched. I said, yeah, that's me. I'm Darren in Bewitched.
That's brilliant. That's so funny. Well, I think we've run out of time.
We're getting there, but let me just ask a quick question.
I just want to say, so these spots, to answer your question, during the course of the playoffs, were seen by 28 million people.
Wow.
28 million people. And about a month after, the NBA called us up and said, John, I just want to thank you guys again because we're getting all kinds of calls and letters and emails from people all over the country saying they've never seen anything like this before. And here's the kicker. A month later, I get an invitation that I thought was a joke that's from the White House saying you are one of the people we'd like to honor at the White House at a big reception for your efforts for public service. So a month later, I was at a White House reception, which was pretty cool.
That's right. Yeah. Was the president there?
The first woman, the first lady was there. But it was this again back in the dark ages. 1991, it was Barbara Bush. So I had a photo op with Barbara.
Even though cool. I don't politically agree with Bush Senior, there does seem to be a human etiquette that he and his wife held that I appreciate.
Yeah. So as you look at your life now with the company Big Idea Videos, what's the mission and vision for that currently in your life?
Okay. So, again, I could go till the hour, so we don't need to feel rushed. Yeah, I'm just looking. I can go 10 or 15 more minutes. Big Idea was a company I started in 2015 and only did for a few years because then I realized that I kind of did a assessment of my finances and realized that I don't really need to work anymore. So that's when I decided to focus on my documentary film and my guitar playing and singing. And that started in 2013 because at the time, do you guys recall explainer videos?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So that was a big thing in 2012, 2013. And I was seeing friends of mine who, were good at animation, but knew nothing about advertising concept, make a killing doing animation for explainer videos that weren't that good creatively. So I figured, let me just get some software and learn how to do a little animation. And I could, you know, I could be selling myself as a problem solver for these kinds of things. So they weren't all explainer type videos, but, that's what I did for a couple of years.
Got it.
I do need to wrap. Yeah, we could go on. Like maybe we need a part two, cause there's so many questions plowing through my head hole, but I've got a meeting at 11.
That's cool. That's cool.
So we have a question that we ask all our guests, and you may know this question and you may not. So we're going to ask it. It means a lot to us. And I'm glad you talked about musicianship because it's part and parcel to that, John. So the question is Eminem or Foo Fighters?
You know, I'm a classic rock guy, so I could care less between the two of those. But I would go with Foo Fighters because I actually do know a couple of Foo Fighters songs, and I don't know any by Eminem. So there you go.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, John, it's been a pleasure. I wish your band the best. What's the name of your band?
Well, I haven't introduced it yet to the guys I'm jamming with, but I'm thinking of calling it the Classic Rockers.
Okay.
And include a visual of a rocking chair in there.
Nice. Oh, will it be awesome. Covers or will you have original?
Yeah, it's all cover stuff. It's all, you know,
you Santana,
you know, a lot of San Francisco groups from back in the day. And
got it. Psychedelic.
Yeah. Damn it. We need a part two because forget it. Anyway.
So there's one other option we have here. You can say yes or no to this. We have a 30-second spot. And we're prepped to show it to you. And at the end of that, you get to say thumbs up, thumb down, or give us a score if you're willing to play.
Well, you're putting me on the spot here because chances are I'm going to think it sucks.
It does suck.
and And I'd rather say that without saying it, because it's just like if a client came to me and said, we have a commercial, right? What do you think of our commercial? Chances are it's going to suck. But for all the reasons I just mentioned here earlier, they don't have the perspective. I don't know what they're doing. I don't know what the strategy is. I don't know. So just to show something for creativity without knowing anything, what you're trying to do, who you're speaking to, I don't even feel qualified to comment on it. You know what I'm saying?
I think we should end with that. I don't need to see it. It sucks.
You know, how about this? I don't need to see it. It's great.
All right. We'll end on that.
Let's leave it at that. Okay.
Recording stopped.